From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, 25 years after as many as a million people were killed in the Rwandan genocide, what has the world learned from it and the justice that came afterwards?
Later, Wisconsin lawmakers consider the state's first legislation expressly addressing dyslexia.
I've heard quite a bit of testimony today, and one of the things that's really starting to well up in me is the lack of acknowledgement of the word dyslexia in schools, which prevents anything proactive from happening.
And the head of the Women's Center of Waukesha talks about the challenges in helping assault survivors recover from their trauma.
Especially around sexual assault, it's very hard for everybody to understand and reconcile what that is. And we don't want to believe it's true. We don't want to believe that someone we know has been harmed. So we try to rationalize it away. That's very damaging to that victim.
Lake Effect is next after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. It has been 25 years since the genocide in Rwanda, in which the ruling Hutu majority government slaughtered as many as 1 million Tutsi people. By most measures, life in Rwanda is vastly different today, as a full generation has been born since the end of the Civil War hostilities there.
But human rights observers say, despite the general changes for the better in Rwanda, there are reasons to be wary of the possibility of another genocide like the one from the 1990s. Karine Kaneza Nantulia is the Africa Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. She spoke at several events in Milwaukee recently and also stopped by the Lake Effect studio to chat with Bonnie North. Nantulia says part of the legacy of that time in Rwanda is linked to what's known as transitional justice.
Transitional justice is commonly referred as the body, a set of processes that a country, in collaboration with the international community, will set in motion in order to address a legacy of gross human rights violations. It's important because, and I'm saying this coming from a continent which has its own share of human rights abuses, it's important because people need to deal with what happened in their lives, whether it's about gruesome acts of violence, such as genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. So on one hand, you have the prosecution aspect of transitional justice, but at the same time, you also have to remember that victims, because we're talking about victims and perpetrators, need to have their suffering acknowledged. So you will have, for instance, an aspect of truth-telling to the transitional justice process. You will have an aspect of compensation, and some of it is symbolic, such as an acknowledgement of an apology by the state to its citizens. And at the same time, you also need to have, you might see aspects to the compensation that's material and financial as well. So it's a body of different processes, reparation, truth-telling, prosecution, where victims most of the time will be the center. Should be the center. It's not always the case, but victims should be the center of these processes.
What I like about the word transitional is the understanding that it doesn't end with a prosecution. It doesn't end with a verdict of guilty, that there is more to it.
There's rehabilitation. There's rehabilitation of the victim, but also of the perpetrators. Because when you think of gross human rights violations such as genocide, for instance, or crimes against humanity, these are most of the time crimes committed by people within their own countries, neighbors killing neighbors, parents killing children, children killing parents. So ultimately, when a community has been literally destroyed, its soul, its people, its institutions, the next phase is to acknowledge what has happened in terms of prosecuting the perpetrators. Yes, justice has to be rendered because that's what victims need. But at the same time, they also need to come to terms with the fact that these crimes were committed by people they knew. they were committed by people they might have loved, people they trusted. So how do you deal with that social and cultural aspect to the crime? And that's, unfortunately, when one reflects back, you would assume that some answers, clear answers, would have been found. Some have, but we're still grappling with that. We're still grappling with the fact that justice is not always rendered to its fullest. Victims up until now, when you think of countries like South Africa, for instance, with the end of apartheid and South Africa, which came up with a groundbreaking process called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you still, when you read the account of victims, you still see a level of insatisfaction, of frustration. Same thing in other countries. Sierra Leone is another example. In Uganda, in northern Uganda, with crimes committed by the Lord's Resistance Army, how do you have a fulfilling process? I think that's what policymakers, transitional justice practitioners, lawyers, human rights advocates are still, I think, pursuing.
It's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And now we're talking about genocide. We are at the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. Did we miss warning signs 25 years ago?
Genocide, and in the case of Rwanda, does not happen in a vacuum. Many people have said this before me. Many people will say this after me. It starts with an idea. It starts with what we call an ideology of genocide, which is rooted within how the country is governed. So it starts most of the time with the leaders. But it's also vehicled. It's actually driven at the smallest unit of a country, in families, inside families. Warning signs were there. They were there from the moment on an ID card you had the word Hutu and Tutsi. And that was during the colonial period. From the time you see a discrimination, a separation of identity, meaning of status, then you know that something is set in motion. So we saw the warning sign, the fact that a social, economic, cultural identity was transformed and moved from that to become an avenue for advantages, an avenue for discrimination, the warning sign was already alarming. And then you had separate treatment. You had institutional segregation of a minority, and in this case of Tutsis, for decades. And at the time when, and on the continent, especially in our region, every time there's going to be a talk of inclusion, a process that most of the time the international community is going to start by pushing for certain different governance dispensation, you will always have the radicals, you will always have those who want to retain power, who will then set in motion this terrible evil that was unleashed in Rwanda. So we saw the signs. Now the question we need to ask ourselves, if we were to see the same signs today, and we are, would we react earlier? Unfortunately, that answer has not been what we would expect. We look at countries like Burundi, a neighboring country. You look at countries like South Sudan. As we speak right now, there's a hybrid court that has been set up, a mixed court with participation of South Sudanese judges and AU. With the AU, it hasn't been set up yet. You still see hesitations. You still see a lack of political will. And yet we have 4 million people who have been displaced. We have women who have been raped. We have rape that has been deemed and legalized as a weapon, as a crime against humanity, still being used today, 25 years after the genocide in Rwanda, where actually rape was also used. So what do we do? What do we do with what we knew then, what we what we took as policy steps, we have the responsibility to protect that was adopted in 2005. Is it being used today? Do we see meaningful steps being taken to protect civilians? Because that's why the responsibility to protect as a principle was adopted. We don't. I work for an organization that up until now, which documented, raised the alarm, and is still raising the alarm today, 25 years later. We need to take a step back, really looking at ourselves, looking at the international community, and really asking hard questions to policymakers, to leaders, and ask them, what have you learned? Because you've learned something, and why aren't you doing enough today?
And I sit here listening to you and think we don't seem to have learned anything. Or what we have learned, it's too difficult to put into place. It's too complicated, whatever the excuses are, to ignore the warning signs, the failed attempts to make this. And so I have to ask you, do you ever lose hope that human beings will ever sit down and be able to look at themselves clearly enough and say, you know, we're doing it again. Here we are. We're doing it again. Hold up the mirror.
Here's what gives me hope. The youth on the continent. There is a wave of youth movements which has risen. The young people have risen in the last couple of years to actually own and push from the ground some dictatorships and some autocratic governments to actually do better by them. I'm always struck and I always admire youth movements. If you think of the Lucha movement in the DRC, you think of the protests that took place in Burundi in 2015. You think of Togo. You think of the youth movement in Nigeria, Ghana. You have all these different countries where young people are now more and more agents of change. And I think when we talk about the responsibility to protect as a principle, it is now being articulated to a certain extent by young people on the ground. It's unfortunate that at a higher policy level, it's still being used sometimes as a political tool as well, unfortunately. Have we not learned anything? Let me nuance that. After the genocide in Rwanda, some steps were taken. We have today the International Criminal Court. That was established really as a response partly to what happened in Rwanda and, I must add, in former Yugoslavia. You have accountability, although misused and forgotten sometimes. Now, part and parcel, the discussion on governance and policies. You can't escape that. It's part of the discussions that policymakers have. They might not do something about it, but they're aware of it. You have criminal justice now being mainstreamed. It's been mainstreamed now in the discussion around governance, good governance, peace and security. It wasn't there before. So I like to keep hope while being realistic that few steps have been taken in terms of the consciousness. We are more aware. We are more conscious. It's very frustrating when you know that this rise in consciousness in the world has not been translated into something more tangible sometimes. We have, I'm just thinking aloud, but you have, for instance, the African Union recently has adopted a transitional justice policy. And this was in February 2019. And that was a process, that's a process that has taken 10 years, close to 10 years, to come to fruition. Basically to say, here we are, and we're going to adopt a transitional justice policy, looking at issues of justice, redress, compensation, reconciliation. It's a step forward. Now we do have a framework. When next time I'm talking to policymakers, when my colleagues are interacting with policymakers on the continent, we will be able to say, but you do have a framework.
It's here.
It's here.
Yeah.
So let's look at what are you doing in terms of the special court in Central African Republic. What are you doing with South Sudan? What are you doing with the prosecution of the perpetrators of the stadium massacre in 2009 in Guinea? So you have all these different issues we're working on, which will be able to be addressed within a certain framework adopted by member states themselves. So few inroads here and there. It's not perfect.
A few small victories.
They are small things one can push forward.
Do you think that what has been adopted, this transitional justice model that's been adopted by the African Union, are other countries, other regions looking at adopting similar things? Or is that more the purview of the UN for the Human Rights Commission at the UN?
It was developed by the Human Rights and Transitional Justice Cluster within the Department of Political Affairs at the African Union. So it's going to be obviously addressed regionally, but with the intention of domesticating the regulations that are within the policy at a national level. So one will be able to build obviously linkages. The AU, the UN, and the EU have obviously their own dialogue, and they have policy frameworks in which the three institutions meet and they interact, especially now currently on issues of migration, for instance. So there's room to basically try to have a discussion at an international level. But right now, when you think of Africa as a continent, this is a positive development. We'll be able to go to governments, national human rights commissions, and say, hey, this is what's happening. What are you doing? We'll be able to go to the, you know, hopefully in the near future, to the Africa Commission on Human and People's Rights, and basically question some of the country's violations, if they are, on the basis of the policy.
So it does sound like between the youth movement and some of these small but very important policy steps that you are hopeful that, not that we're going to necessarily change human nature, but that we're going to at least look at ourselves a little more closely and hold ourselves to account.
Definitely. The world is changing. The world is more interconnected. We have social media now. I was having a discussion with some of my colleagues and Nicole, and we were talking about how the phenomenon of the Me Too movement, you know, and the wave it has created inside the U.S. is something that could be looked at, you know, from other contexts. And this is just social media. This is just a campaign on social media. There are so many other campaigns. So we are all connected. We are more and more connected. And because of that, I think evil finds it difficult to hide, for instance. It's more and more difficult to commit gruesome acts of violence and gross human rights violations without being uncovered. It's more difficult today than it was in 1994. It's more difficult to basically indoctrinate citizens. In some countries, at least on the continent, there's an increased level of literacy 25 years down the line. So people are aware. Young people who actually were born after the genocide in Rwanda are more resilient. They are more bold. They've been emboldened enough to actually go on the streets and oust, sometimes push leaders to actually leave power. One wouldn't have thought of that 25 years ago. You look at processes on the continent where women have come forward. I'm thinking of women in Uganda during the LRA peace process, where victims would come forward and they would say, this is what happened to me. And those are some of the signs that societies have changed. Actually, we're talking about young people. They're way ahead of us. And hopefully these years are theirs, really.
And that we're not going to look back in another 25 years at another genocide that could have been prevented.
That is where I become sad. Because you do have up until now acts of violence that are still being investigated by commissions of inquiry by the ICC. You have Burundi as a case where when you read what has been written about Burundi, you might be able to actually come to the conclusion that genocide can happen, but it's not going to necessarily take the format and the magnitude in terms of the time it took, 100 years, to kill close to 1 million people. Now we have what has been coined in Kirundi, kamwe kamwe, one by one. So as much as we say that it's difficult to hide, perpetrators have also become cleverer as well and smarter. And that can be a whole discussion how autocratic leaders have now become clever, understood. They have understood the expectations of the international community in such a way that they have a checklist. They will know that they need to hold seemingly democratic elections, even if they steal those elections, and these elections are not fair and not transparent. They know that they need to have a certain percentage of women, for instance, in parliament, and they will try to check all those boxes while at the same time maintaining and recruiting shadow militias. They will recruit young people and indoctrinate them. So you have these parallel systems where one is for the consumption of the international community and the other one is to really fulfill the thirst for power of some of these leaders. So that is what is, in my view, the most worrying trend, because the international community's attention is a very short one. You have competing interests. When you talk about Burundi or you talk about Central African Republic or you talk about Cameroon, at the same time, you have other interests. You will have a political crisis in the Middle East, for instance, or in Asia. And these countries, which, you know, have been coined in some of the writings that you see as forgotten crises, really, again, fall into oblivion, and policymakers will not be keeping a close eye on them. And that's how terrible things can happen again and are happening as we speak right now.
Which makes me both hopeful and very sad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But we must keep pushing. We must keep pushing, because I think evil can only take root when people are silent. Evil thrives when people are just standing by and not doing anything. Evil wins when we are not exposing it, when we are not documenting it. So that body of work must continue. And it's more and more, linking it to what I said before, more and more you will see that because criminal justice is so mainstreamed right now, leaders will actually be scared more with the threat of being indicted. It's a reality right now. You know, we have indictments. We have leaders who've been, not many, unfortunately, and who have been put on trial. Perpetrators who've been put on trial. Yeah, so those are some of the things that one has to keep remembering.
Well, Corinne Caneza Nantulya, it has been such an honor having you in this studio. Thank you very much for your good work.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And keep your good work. Keep spreading the word.
Corinne Caneza Nantulya is the Africa Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. She was in Milwaukee recently for events marking the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide and spoke with Bonnie North then.
We'll take a quick break now and then chat with education reporter Emily Files about potential legislation that would serve students with dyslexia in Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Wisconsin lawmakers are considering what could be the state's first dyslexia-specific legislation. Dyslexia is a reading disorder that affects between 5 and 20% of the population. People with dyslexia have a hard time connecting written words with spoken language.
Last week, families flooded the state capitol to testify in support of a bill that would create a dyslexia guidebook for educators. The testimony was emotional and made the case that action to better serve dyslexic students is long overdue. WUWM education reporter Emily Files listened to the more than 5 hours of testimony. She joins us now to explain more. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Joy.
So what did you hear from the people who were speaking out about this dyslexia legislation?
They were overwhelmingly in favor of it. But the testimony was really about more than just the specific piece of legislation. It was about how painful it is to be a student who struggles to read and a parent of a struggling reader. Here's one example. This is student Shelby Ward from Clinton, Wisconsin. Her dyslexia went unidentified for years, and she hated reading out loud in class so much that she would pretend to be sick so that she would be sent to the nurse's office.
I missed the time in reading class because I was held in a nurse's office complaining of illness. So that I didn't have to read out loud. It took up to fourth grade for me to get diagnosed with dyslexia. I was tested outside of school, so my parents had to pay in out of their pocket. I did not get an IEP plan until I was in fourth grade. It took too long for any child to go without getting help that they needed. Thank you.
And then here's Mother Kathy Klein of Madison. Her son is in third grade and he has dyslexia.
I am one of the parents who quit my job and started tutoring my son at home. And I take him out of school early every day to tutor him because he has autism and I can't take him to a private tutor. So I'm doing it. I am the last chance for my son. I am his one chance. But I can do it because I have the money. Thank God I have the money. My son goes to a Title I school in Madison, and there are a lot of kids in his school who are not reading at grade level. And it is just wrong, and it makes me so mad.
So you heard both of them talk about having to go outside of school to get the help that they needed. Shelby went to a private tutor and Kathy started tutoring her son herself, and she quit her job to do that. This was a common theme for the families affected by dyslexia. It painted a picture of systemic failures in Wisconsin public schools to recognize dyslexia and properly address it.
The testimony is so powerful and so emotional. And it seems like from both of the stories that we just heard, this is a systemic issue. You know, why is that? Why would schools not address dyslexia?
I'm sure there are differences from school district to school district, but there were several former teachers who spoke at this hearing. And what they said is that their teacher preparation programs at universities and colleges in Wisconsin didn't teach them about dyslexia and how to address it. And they didn't learn about the reading instruction that dyslexic kids need. Kim Feller Janis lives in Fitchburg, and she used to be a public school teacher. She testified last week.
Being a reading teacher and a literacy coach was often very rewarding as I received excellent feedback from parents and administration alike. But after 7 years, I decided to resign. I needed time to figure out why there was always a small group of very bright children who continued to struggle to learn to read even after months and months of intervention.
Did she figure out what was going on with those students?
They were probably dyslexic. And she says as a reading teacher, she wasn't using the right strategies to teach those kids to read. The big picture here is that spoken language comes naturally to most people, but reading is not a natural process. You need to learn how to decode how letters translate into sounds. That's called phonics. Some kids pick up reading easily without explicit phonics instruction, but dyslexic kids usually don't.
And even though this kind of reading instruction has been proven to be effective with dyslexic students, so many families have to go outside of their schools to get that instruction for their children.
Yeah, that was something that both of the first speakers really pointed out, really emphasized. Why do they have to go outside of the schools?
A lot of schools use reading instruction that tends to leave dyslexic students behind. They might use whole language or balanced literacy methods. And with those methods of reading instruction, there might be some phonics, but the emphasis is reading comprehension and reading for meaning. This debate over whole language versus phonics goes back decades. It was so controversial at one point that it was called the Reading Wars. People testified at this hearing that the reading wars are still playing out in Wisconsin, and that means dyslexic children often aren't getting the instruction that they would most benefit from.
So right now there's a bill before legislators to create a dyslexia guidebook. Would that fix the problem here?
The dyslexia guidebook recommendation came from a study committee made up of lawmakers and members of the public. And a lot of families and experts who testified said it would be a good first step. If the legislation passed, the guidebook would be posted on the Department of Public Instruction website and school district websites. It would be a place for schools and parents to turn for answers, but it wouldn't mandate any changes in the way schools teach reading or in the way that they identify or don't identify dyslexia, which is what seems to be the more deeply rooted issue here. So the lawmakers on the Assembly Education Committee, which heard all of this emotional testimony, a lot of them realized that this guidebook might not be, you know, a fix for the entire problem here. So this is Representative Timothy Rampton.
I've heard quite a bit of testimony today, and one of the things that's really starting to well up in me is the lack of acknowledgement of the word dyslexia in schools.
Absolutely.
Which prevents anything proactive from happening. And so we have this reactive bill thing, but it's not enough based on the previous expression.
So it's possible that legislators might propose some stronger action, maybe something that has to do with teacher training or screening for dyslexia in schools. Either way, this dyslexia guidebook bill, if nothing else, provided some eye-opening testimony about the uphill battle many Wisconsin families face to get dyslexic students the education they need.
Yeah. That's WUWM's education reporter Emily Files with an update on dyslexia legislation that is currently being considered in the state legislature. Emily, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
One more break, and then we'll learn about the efforts and services of the Women's Center of Waukesha, which works to support women, children, and even men affected by violence and other forms of abuse. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Last week, Lake Effect and WUWM News featured reporter Mayon Silver's series on the issue of human trafficking in the Milwaukee area. It's a significant problem in the area, but so are other sex crimes. Nationally, statistics indicate that nearly one in five women have experienced rape or attempted rape at some point in their lives.
While April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, the Women's Center of Waukesha works year-round to broaden the conversation and bring greater awareness to sexual violence and the efforts being made to combat it. The center has been in operation for more than 40 years and serves women, children, and men impacted by domestic abuse, sexual violence, child abuse, and trafficking.
Angela Mancuso is the executive director of the Women's Center, and she recently joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss the center's history and how it's adapted over time to help those who need support.
The movement, as it were, really started around the 70s. That's when a lot of domestic violence or sexual assault organizations came about. So they're pretty progressive, though. Five very tenacious women, so we refer to them as our founding mothers. But, you know, the work that we do today is the work that they articulated in 1977. So I just think that's really cool and an interesting fact about the Women's Center. So what we primarily do is we work with adult and child survivors of domestic violence, child abuse, sexual assault, and human trafficking. And we do that through a number of comprehensive programs. You know, we have an emergency crisis shelter for individuals who need that immediate safe place to stay. We have transitional living, so that's for individuals that can live in the apartments for up to 2 years and still be connected to our programs. We have a counseling model, so we have counselors who are, you know, trauma-informed, who will conduct one-on-one short-term crisis counseling sessions with adults and for children. So I have adult counselors and I have youth counselors. And then we also do ongoing support groups and topic nights. We do job readiness training and employment counseling and support, and also life skills development. We have a legal advocacy model, so we have advocates that are co-located at the Waukesha County Courthouse and at the Women's Center, and we're really helping with restraining orders or doing court supports. We do children's programming. We provide free child care for anybody who's using any of those programs. And we do a lot of violence prevention work in school. So we've been really busy the last, really since 2017, in a lot of middle and high schools where we're talking about healthy relationships, consent, how to work through conflict, things like that. So, and we have a 24-hour hotline. So with all of those programs, a duplicated number will be about 15,000 or 16,000 a year that we will work with.
And that's a far-reaching impact that goes beyond what people may first think when they hear the Women's Center. They're
Correct.
Probably only thinking of adult women. And although issues such as domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and human trafficking, these aren't new problems. And as you said, you were founded in 1977 and
Correct.
Have the same mission and continue to do so. How have you needed to grow and adapt in order to tackle these issues as they morph or become more pervasive, or there's different ways to spot them or educate people about them?
Right. So our name being the Women's Center, and in 1977, it was, you know, these were considered women's issues. In fact, you know, it used to be called displaced homemakers. That was some of the language. So some of the evolution is that we work with all genders at the Women's Center. And that has been a change over the years, is that, you know, statistically speaking, so domestic violence, sexual assault are grossly underreported crimes. The stats that are out there are reflecting data that has been reported, which dictates that still the large percentage of victimizations are women and the large percentage of perpetrators are men. However, you know, that is changing a lot. And that's data that is also pretty specific to, you know, when we talk about, let's say, 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime, well, that number is actually significantly higher in communities of color or in the LGBTQ communities. So when you take all of that into account, these are really egregious, prevalent crimes that are happening across all communities. There's no socioeconomic boundaries to these kinds of crimes. And that has been part of the evolution since 1977 is, of course, branching out, serving anybody who has been affected and harmed by these issues, not just women. And I think also, like, human trafficking is another example where it's not a new phenomena. It has a name to it now, and it certainly is an issue that needed to be brought to the forefront and to be talked about. But really, violence in the home, domestic violence, child abuse, sexual assault, human trafficking have been going on since the dawn of humankind.
Tackling all of these issues, you know, not necessarily tackling them at once, but having the resources to be able to address and help survivors go through every step. Do you find that it's a trend to have, you know, for lack of a better word, a one-stop service center? And how does that impact your ability to minimize further trauma for the people who need these services and establish trust to better serve the community?
Well, we do actually tackle all of the issues at once. Because we have to, you know, that's based off of demand and what who's coming through our doors and what they need. But it has been a trend, I would say, maybe over the last 5 to 8 years, because agencies that are addressing domestic violence or sexual assault, they're complex situations and there's so much that goes into it. I mean, there's the legal system, right? The criminal justice system. It could be child protective services. It could be a school, a hospital, lawyers, supportive agencies. So it can be really overwhelming, especially when you are that individual that has been traumatized and harmed. It can be really overwhelming to, you know, it's like, wait, oh, I have to go there, you know, and it's like all I want is to start on my healing path, you know. So it is a benefit to have as much as you possibly can under one roof. Again, it removes some barriers, right? So for individuals who they don't have a car or they're taking public transportation, or if they're coming from Milwaukee out to Waukesha to the Women's Center, it's just better to have as much as we can under one roof to make things easier. It can be just exhausting, you know, to travel all around to get your needs met. And there are certainly, we're not all things to all people, so we try to provide what our clients are telling us that they need. And then what we don't have on site, we're making referrals. But what we prefer to do is bring that outside partner to us. It can also be less intimidating, you know, if people are comfortable. It's a big deal to come forward, right, to seek help. So we're just trying to make things as easy as possible. We provide bus tickets. We provide, you know, cab fare, gas cards. That's why we provide the on-site child care for clients. So, again, we can just try to ease the burden of everything that they have to go through, because the onus really is on them. They have to advocate for themselves. So our role is to be their partner and to provide a foundation, make it as easy and as smooth as possible.
With all of the services under one roof, what kind of tracking or collection are you doing for your purposes of, you know, what areas you have the most concentration of resources? Or do you see, okay, this month or this year we had more percentage of domestic violence clients that we helped, or anything along those lines?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I'm going to say no. I mean, we do lots of data collection. And I guess if we looked at the demand, for instance, our emergency shelter, so that's 32 beds. So we end up turning away a lot of families because we're full all the time. So that would be one sort of trend we would monitor from maybe quarter to quarter, and then of course year to year. Like, well, how many families did we have to turn away? Does this mean we have to come up with a different configuration of rooms? Does it mean there's more violence, or does it mean that it's the same amount of violence but people are ready to leave? So, you know, it's sort of the Boolean factor, if this then that, when we're looking at our data. But there are some consistent trends. I mean, consistently, the largest population we see is, you know, 18 to 30-year-olds. We have seen an uptick in elder abuse needs. We have seen an increase in men needing supportive services from us, either on the domestic violence or sexual assault side. Those are trends that have been going on, I would say, for, you know, the last couple of years. But other than that, these are crimes that are so prevalent and are committed every day in every community, in every subset of every community, that's the trend. You know, it's like it just keeps happening despite awareness, and people need more supportive services.
And I imagine these crimes can be interrelated also. It's not strictly one branch stays separate. Someone who perhaps experienced domestic violence could also have sexual assault, survival stories, and all interwoven within each other.
Yeah, that's exactly right, which is why we serve, you know, when we say we work with survivors of those sort of four categories, if you will, and then within those, there's, you know, a lot more detail. But right, domestic violence and sexual assault are highly linked, and child abuse and trafficking can also be linked, or trafficking and domestic violence. I mean, so right, they're all very symbiotic issues.
Where do you believe that the disconnect still remains when it comes to understanding sexual assault and its aftermath? You know, as you mentioned, it goes vastly underreported, with 63% of assaults unreported, and our culture is still one of victim blaming and shaming. There is some movement to change that, but, you know, it's not something that can be fixed overnight. So how do you think we can change the way we talk about these issues?
Well, I think you're on point when it doesn't change overnight. I mean, as a society, we're really quick to move on to the next new shiny thing, but real change happens over time, and it's a process. It's not an event. It's not just going to happen. So I think that's part of the disconnect, is that it can seem like a never-ending, exhausting wave of victim blaming and shaming. And when you think about, it seems like we move three steps forward and then it's five steps back. So 2017, right, was the really big year. That was big year for the Me Too movement and everything that was going on in Hollywood and D.C. and lots of awareness, lots of discussions about it. Yet we were busier than ever. So then people would say, well, what happened there? Well, Harvey Weinstein, what does he mean to us? What does he mean to little old me, you know, from Milwaukee? I don't know him. It can be hard to identify. It's like, as a, you know, survivors, you hear about all these issues in D.C. or Hollywood, but how does that relate? Because you have a different community and you're coming at it from a different perspective. So we have yet to have somebody call our hotline and say, hey, yeah, I just saw that my favorite celebrity came forward and said that, you know, they are a survivor, so I'm going to do that too. That doesn't happen, you know? And it's because, again, it's a more personal choice that one makes. But I think when we have something positive like Me Too and lots of discussions, but then we have the Brock Turners and the Baylor University fraternity president literally walking away, and that has a ripple effect on survivors, of course. And those are classic examples of victim blaming and shaming, because it is the victim that has to do all the work. It's the victim that has to prove that they did not want to be victimized. I mean, who does that, right? So we focus as a culture so much on, you won't get sexually assaulted if you don't wear this, if you don't walk there, if you don't drink this much, if you, you know, but really we need to shift all that energy to, here's why you will not sexually assault somebody. Here's boundaries. Here's respect. This is what coping mechanisms are if you don't get your own way. I mean, that's what we need to make this shift towards. You know, it isn't, why did she get raped? It's why did that perpetrator do that?
And you mentioned you're going into schools and having these kinds of discussions, because obviously as we're conditioned to learn these types of behaviors or be blamed for certain types of behaviors, how are you trying to help adults be more aware of and change the way they are speaking about the issues, or even how they speak to a survivor in order to support them?
Right. It's sort of like the walk a mile in their shoes. You know, you really have to, if you are not coming from that kind of trauma, it's really pausing before you speak, really thinking about this. Because it's, first of all, recognizing that it is a huge, it's a big deal when someone discloses to you. And when they do, they've thought about it. And it's very personal and profound for them. And then the friend or family member that they, you know, are disclosing to says, wow, that, I'm really sorry that happened to you. Why were you walking down the street by yourself? And they don't have malintent when they say that. They're just not stopping to think what that means, how that can alienate their friend, or what did you do to make your partner so mad? You know, it's like, well, wait, I'm just existing. You know, that's what happened, apparently. But it can be very alienating when someone judges. And that's what happens when we say, or the at leasts, you know, at least you didn't get hurt, or at least you're still alive. Well, okay, that is the least comforting statements to say. So it's just being very mindful of not alienating that individual. So really, you know, again, as human beings, we have this desire to tie everything up in a neat box and rationalize it immediately with what works for us, because especially around sexual assault, it's very hard for everybody to understand and reconcile what that is. And we don't want to believe it's true. We don't want to believe that someone we know has been harmed. So we try to rationalize it away. That's very damaging to that victim. You know, so just don't say a lot. You know, what we say is, you know, if you say anything, just say, I'm sorry that happened to you. Say, I believe you. You can say, when you're ready to talk, I'm here for you. Is there anything that I can do for you right now? And then just stop talking and give that survivor some space, because they may not know what they need in that moment. But if you say things that are very victim-blaming or alienating, you run the risk of really pushing them away from you. And, you know, in domestic violence situations, oftentimes victims are already so isolated from their friends and family because that's what abusers do. It's a tactic. So then for them to finally come out and say something, and then they just can get pushed into more isolation, and that could be dangerous.
Well, yeah, and to have that misstep also, I think, plays into how people think about a healing process. You know, if they're not coming from it from a sense of empathy and truly understanding or not having a similar experience, they may not understand that the healing is not a straightforward process. So what do you want people to know about that as well?
Right. You know, and that's a great point. You know, that victims know themselves better than anybody else, even if it's a victim disclosing to somebody who has also had experienced that kind of trauma. They don't know better than that individual. I don't know better than the people who are in front of me. And it's really respecting people's space and respecting their process. Everybody's process is different. It is unique. So when people come to us at the Women's Center, they're coming under the same umbrella, right? But their needs are different. Their personalities are different. Their experiences are different. So we don't have a cookie cutter model. It's literally catered and customized to each individual, each child, each family, each adult that is sitting in front of us. And it's based on what they feel comfortable with and what they feel that they're capable of doing at that time. So it could be very small steps, or some people want to take a big leap at a time. But just to respect and understand that it is their own journey. You don't know better than they do, and you can't understand what they have gone through in their own personal experience. They need to feel ready, and people need to feel safe too, you know, and safe on each step of their journey, which is a component that the Women's Center provides. But it's just treating survivors with dignity and respect and letting them choose their own path. That can be really hard for people, especially when you are feeling so bad that something so horrible happened to someone you know. But it's, you know, your role is not the fixer. Your role is the supporter.
Angela Mancuso is the executive director of the Women's Center Incorporated in Waukesha. At WUWM.com, you can find more information about the organization and also its luncheon tomorrow featuring actor and advocate Terry Crews as the keynote speaker via satellite.
We should also mention that if you need help or services from the Women's Center, you can reach out to their 24-hour confidential hotline at 262-542-3828. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.